Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy to order. It's January 20th, 1:15, and today is going to be devoted to transformation, an informational meeting on transformation. And with that, I would like to call Mike Bonetto, Bruce Goldberg up to start us off on this wonderful journey that we're on. Eric Parsons from the Health Policy Board is also with us. And then you'll introduce. Yeah. Okay.
Great. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority. I'm going to give you the lineup for the next hour or so in terms of really four things we were hoping to do, and we've got a number of people to help us do that, which is Eric Parsons is going to walk through very quickly the background around the implementation proposal that the policy board's been working on. Mike's going to walk us very quickly through the LEDGE concept. And then we're going to spend, though, the bulk of our time on two pieces of information. One is we have on the phone Doug Elwell, who will introduce, who is going to walk through the outside financial analysis that we've had done about the kinds of savings we can expect over the long term from this transformation effort. And then finally, we have, as promised, some information on medical liability and some consultants from both here in Portland as well as from Boston who will be on the line to help us walk us through that. And I'll try and sort of keep us moving. And so I'm going to turn things very quickly over to Eric Parsons, who's the chair of the Health Policy Board.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I am Eric Parsons from Portland. I am the chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board, excuse me, and I'm pleased to give you a brief status on the implementation proposal for coordinated care organizations as required by House Bill 3650. The Health Policy Board has made good progress this month towards finalizing the proposal. As you know, it is being developed with a considerable amount of public input and reflects the efforts of four work groups and feedback received at eight statewide community meetings and monthly policy board meetings since the passage of House Bill 3650 last year. The version you have before you is the second draft of the proposal and has gone through two rounds of public comment. The Health Policy Board will review the proposal one more time next week and will then send it to the legislature for approval. The CCO implementation proposal, when finalized and approved by the legislature, will be used by potential CCOs to form their organizations and by CMS as they look at the waivers that Oregon will be requesting that will give us the flexibility we need for CCOs to be successful. Since we last met with you in December, the board has received a report on the financial benefits to the state of implementing the coordinated care organization model of care, and Bruce will be talking more about that shortly as he described. When we talk about CCOs, people have asked us to be very clear about just what we mean. As you know, CCOs are local health entities that deliver health care and coverage for people eligible for Medicaid through the Oregon Health Plan, including OHP members who are also covered by Medicare. They have one point of accountability for health outcomes and one budget that grows at a fixed rate for mental, physical, and ultimately dental care. They will bring forward new models of care that are patient-centered and team-focused. They will have considerable flexibility within the budget to deliver the outcomes that are expected of them. And they will be governed by a partnership among providers of care, community members, and stakeholders in the health systems that have financial responsibility and risk. I'd like to comment very briefly on just two or three of the key elements of the implementation proposal. Governance will be local and flexible. Excuse me. CCO organizational structures will vary to meet the needs of the communities that they'll serve. There's no single governance solution, and we believe there is risk in being too prescriptive beyond the statutory definition of a CCO governing board. To that end, our board recommends that the majority of the governing board for CCOs will be made up of those who bear financial potential risk, and they should also reflect the needs of the communities the CCO will serve.
And before you go on, I think this was what Senator Shields was concerned about regarding people on the boards are the ones that are going to have financial risk. And so I know you just came in, but I wanted you to make sure that you hear the reasoning from them.
All yes, right, indeed.
Proceed.
Thank you very much. We believe that also one member of the Community Advisory Council should serve on the governing board, and we also recognize that House Bill 3650 encourages partnerships between CCOs and local mental health authorities and county governments in order to take advantage of and support the critical safety net services available through county health departments and other publicly supported programs. Our board supports
yes,
these partnerships.
Senator
yes.
I'm going to interrupt at various points so I don't forget. That's an issue because you're talking about counties basically being outside of the governing structure of the CCO, and you're also talking about those with risk being on the board, and counties certainly have risk.
We agree, and we believe that depending upon the decisions made at the local level, the counties can be very much involved in the governance or can be involved in contractual relationships. We believe it needs to be worked out at the local level, but what our board is saying is that the counties need to be fully included and recognized.
And I would agree with that. I guess from my perspective, those that are carrying the risk and bringing the risk into the system, because there will have to be risk modeling, and that will have to be pooled at some point in time. They'd almost have to be inside for that pooling to happen. And I also think those with risk need to have a voice in the decision and not just a contractual relationship.
We agree. The topic of financial risk, the definition of financial risk, is actually on the agenda as one of the final points that we need to consider at our meeting next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question? So essentially what you're proposing is kind of a simple bill, then there'd be this other document, and if the Health Policy Board decides what financial risk is, that's not binding the legislature in any way to determine what financial risk is. We could change the document you present without having to go back to the Health Policy Board. Is that correct?
Let me chime in. The short answer, Chair Mona Sanderson and Senator Shields, the short answer is certainly the legislature can put whatever they would like into statute. The implementation proposal that the board has been working on has been really a guideline that is going to be a guideline for the agency for us to implement this by. It would certainly be what I would consider what you as a legislature will hold the agency accountable for doing, and that you'll see in the legislative concept that it's our notion that we'll come back and report quarterly to the appropriate legislative oversight committee to be certain of that. But at this point, there isn't a definition of some of these things in statute. That would happen through rule and through implementation.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Moving on, the global budget should allow CCOs flexibility to invest in care that will decrease costs and achieve better outcomes. The more programs, services, and funding streams that are included in CCO global budgets, the more flexibility and room for innovation exists for CCOs to provide comprehensive, person-centered care. Leaving necessary care outside of the global budget creates conflicting incentives where the action of payers outside the CCO, who have little reason to contribute to CCO efficiencies, may have undue impact on costs and incomes outcomes within the CCO. To that end, the board recommends that all Medicaid dollars be included in the CCO budget, with the exclusion of Medicaid-funded long-term care and mental health drugs. This should also include people enrolled in OHP Plus, SCHIP, OHP Standard, and those who are fully eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Just a clarification on that, because I don't know the details, but I do believe there are some Medicaid dollars that go to schools, kind of an administrative function. I mean, are you rolling everything in, or will there be discrete decisions there? And my concern is potential impacts on schools by jerking money away from them. It's not a lot of money, but...
The intent of the policy board is to include all of the reasonable funding streams that we can within the CCO budgets, to the extent that there's a good reason to do an exclusion. So I think the staff would be
okay. So this isn't necessarily blanket. It will be discrete decisions. Like I say, that's not a lot of money from the perspective of OHP, but from the perspective of some of the schools, it may be a significant piece.
Our board would be comfortable with that approach.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
And let me just chime in, Senator. I think as you know, I would say that that's an administrative funding stream that's never been really seen as what I would consider to be a healthcare patient care funding stream. And so we have to certainly use some judgment. And I think the notion of this was, how do we take the Medicaid dollars that are for the care of patients?
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted that on the record. So.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, Mike Bonetto with the Governor's Office. Senator Cruz, you brought up a great point, and in our document on the implementation proposal, if you have time to go to Appendix F, it starts to outline all of these specific funding streams of Medicaid, and that's really where I think the board was trying to get its arms around, and really I think had a better understanding of just how much of a silo effect that we've created over time. So we really want trying to identify all of those and figure out how do we get those into the global budget.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. I just there's concerns here that it's best if we kind of address them up front, and I, a couple of days ago, I admonished Dr. Goldberg that, because we keep talking global budget, and this is a global Medicaid budget. So,
correct. Very good. Thank you. We also think that without exception, funding and responsibility for all current services provided by managed physical and mental health organizations, as well as non-emergent transportation, should be included in each CCO's global budget. We think that budget should be tied to a fixed rate of growth rather than medical inflation, so that cost increases slow to the point where they are not outpacing the revenue available as they do today. And initial CCO global budget amounts, we believe, should be established for 1 year for the first year. And once there's some experience established, we hope that stakeholders and OHA will explore the possibility of establishing global budgets that could be enacted on a biennial or multi-year basis. Another point we'd like to bring to your attention is that there is natural tension in balancing between local flexibility and accountability.
Yes.
The board has discussed this in great detail, as you might guess, and we've received a wide variety of input. We note that House Bill 3650 directs OHA to develop a set of metrics that would be included in contracts. A quality, outcomes, and efficiency work group was created that developed principles, measurement domains, and some example metrics. Our board recommends that the next step be to establish a technical work group with responsibility for developing a core set of CCO metrics, pending legislative approval of the implementation proposal. In terms of accountability to the community, the Health Policy Board recommends that CCOs partner with their local public health authorities and hospital systems to develop a shared community needs assessment that includes a focus on health equity issues and health disparities in their community. CCOs would then be expected to report on their progress in addressing identified needs. This can also be described as an effort in administrative simplification, as it would combine three current state and federally required community needs assessments. In conclusion, I just want to thank you for the solid statutory framework that was laid out in House Bill 3650. It has given our board what we needed to build this implementation proposal. I believe that Oregon is ready for the next step in transforming healthcare delivery system, and by doing so, we can create a sustainable system that will improve health and lower costs to the state and ultimately to us all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Chair Monis Anderson, committee members, what I would like to do is just take a few minutes and walk you through LC 97. I believe you have that in your packet. And again, for us, this is just our starting point, so I just wanted to make sure we were all on the same page. And I wanted to highlight a few main points. The first one being on page 1, section 1, And that first sentence that basically says the Assembly approves the proposals presented by OHA as described in Section 13 of House Bill 3650. So when we talk about those proposals, what we're really talking about is what Eric just talked about is this proposal. So this is really kind of the roadmap that we've been putting together that really addresses everything in Section 13 regarding the CCO criteria, the global budget, the outcomes and the metrics, the financial reporting requirements. So we want to make sure that you're kind of understanding kind of the crosswalk of how we're putting all of this together. The next piece I would refer you is to page 5, at the bottom of page 5, section 6. And this highlights more of a technical cleanup on our part, making sure that we have the Department of Consumer Business Services able to communicate and share data with OHA. As we look at some of the financial reporting, we want to make sure that there is kind of the seamless data sharing between both agencies. The next on page 8, section 8, has to do with some provisions around non-discrimination clauses of providers.
Page 6, section 8, my apologies. The numbers look similar, so it's okay.
So in section 8, what LC has done was has taken basically a mirror image of what exists in federal Medicaid statute and has applied it here around specific to non-discrimination. So you can we can read through that. And the intent here really was to use this as a starting point and then see really if there are other changes that are necessary within our current structure today in Medicaid and then have that discussion. But this really wanted to have this as our starting point. Next on page 7.
Can I just, we may have some people a little later on addressing this very issue. It is a concern. I think the fear factor is extremely high among some providers. Say an IPA right now has excluded some providers and I'm not sure how, if you can respond to that or not, but I think I'm let's just say the chiropractors, the optometrists, and nurse practitioners. Can you just elaborate a little bit more on that regarding inclusivity or exclusivity?
Sure. I'll take a crack, and I'll certainly have Dr. Goldberg chime in as well. Madam Chair, I think the intent has been trying to understand, even from their perspective, of what is not working in today's Medicaid structure. I mean, are there discriminatory patterns that exist today that we need to address? I think the idea is that within a CCO structure, when you're dealing with a global budget and an entity that's being held accountable to specific outcomes, we're looking at trying to align those incentives that they are incentivized to look at all providers. And if you have a provider who's delivering great value, it's certainly in that CCO's best interest to look at it, probably expanding that network. And it is, if you have a CCO who is responsible for providing capacity and meeting the access needs of that population, they may have to look beyond kind of a traditional provider lens from today. Questions, comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Cruz.
Yeah. One of the things some of us were discussing this morning would be that anybody who's licensed as a healthcare provider in the state should probably not be excluded. But by the same token, we are trying to incent people in. And if we're trying to incent people in, we don't want roadblocks to those who are viable not being in. And I would also suggest that until we solve the conundrum of fee-for-service, the ability to game the system will always be there. Well, and quite honestly, once we're into a fully capitated system, it's in everybody's best interest to be as efficient as possible, and so.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I would agree, and I think that's really what we're trying to establish, and I think even some dialogue with you in terms of just the amount of flexibility every community would need in terms of putting that network together. But again, being held accountable to a fixed budget and a specific outcomes and having the capacity.
Should be easy, I would think.
Right.
Well, there are patients who have a strong relationship with their provider, and if a CCO then disrupts that, we want to make sure that we are considering the best interests of the patient also.
Madam Chair, I think that's where, you know, outcomes are not simply about how certain medical outcomes, but they're also about access to care. They're also about patient satisfaction and a variety of other factors that I think we need to hold organizations accountable to. So I think it's being able to meet those access, satisfaction, financial, and health outcomes really creates the environment that I think we're all looking for. That's what we want. We want the best possible care. We want it to be accessible. We want people to be satisfied with it. But we also want it to be at a price that we can afford. We can't afford absolutely everything. And it's got to be effective outcome-based care. And I think within that is the ability and the flexibility to assure that CCOs have the flexibility to be able to operate, but also gives, I think, providers of care who provide value and access and relationships the assurance that if they continue to do that, that they will be included. And I think that's what we've been telling all providers is that, you provide good care at a good value and get good outcomes, any CCO worth their salt is obviously going to include you as part of their panel.
Thank you. And lastly, what I would refer you is to page 7, section 11, and this was some new language that we inserted based on some legislative feedback. In terms of us, the OHA, coming back in on a quarterly basis, presenting to, again, the appropriate legislative oversight committee and giving an update in terms of how we're going on the implementation. So I think there was kind of message received in terms of just, having better communication, and I think, we are in full support of that. And kind of however that mechanism needs to occur, we would like to see that. And that is it on my part.
Thank you very much.
So with that, we thought we would now turn things over to on the phone is Doug Elwell. And Doug is a principal with Health Management Associates. He's been a hospital CEO, hospital CFO, has helped form a large Medicaid managed care plan in Indiana. So I think he's got a lot of public-private healthcare financing experience, and brings with him his entire firm that's really helped provide the financial analysis. So wanted to turn things over to Doug to very briefly walk through the financial analysis. I believe you have the entire analysis there. It's the HMA financial analysis. So with that, can turn things over to Doug.
Thank you, Doug. Just introduce yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Yes. My name is Doug Elwell. I'm a managing principal with Health Management Associates. And Chairman Anderson, I'm pleased to be here, and I will go through this as quickly as possible, and people should feel free to ask questions at any point. First, let's talk about the methodology we used. We were not instructed at any time to come up with a specific number or time frame or anything else. We were asked very openly to just come up and take a look at transformation and determine in our professional judgment what we thought was possible and the time frame in which we thought it would be possible. So we started out just looking at the projected enrollment between where we were in 2010, the last year we had complete numbers for, and where we thought you'd end up in 2019. And we basically projected everything at the normal growth rates you've been experiencing, plus what healthcare reform was going to create in 2014. And so based on that, your growth in population really rose from about a little over 550,000 in 2010 to over 950,000 by the end of 2019. So that's pretty significant growth that drove a lot of cost numbers. We also then looked at basically your cost by the different populations in 2010 and laid that in there, and then also looked at what that growth would look like if we did absolutely nothing. And so we laid that across and made that the first determination of this is what happens if the population grows as we expect, and expenditures grow as we expect. We then went in and took a look at the report done by Milliman that looked at particularly at the TANF populations, which are pregnant women and children primarily, and looked at that in terms of where Oregon stood today versus where a well-managed system would look like. And again, they did not characterize Oregon as a poorly managed. They just said, here's where you are today, here's what we think you can get to. And I also want to be clear that this was not picking all the elements that were the lowest cost. In some regions of the state, they actually said there would need to be an additional cost in some categories to bring the system to the lowest cost possible. And the numbers for that particular part of the population ran between 118 million at the low end to 141 million. So that was kind of our starting point. We then went on and looked at other parts of the population. So we looked at the age, blind, and disabled population. And basically for that population, we apply a slightly lower percentage to move from where they were to well-managed. And the reason we did that is, well, these are complex patients that do actually benefit from a well-managed system of care. Some of their costs are not costs that are impacted by management. And the most obvious one I use is individuals with hemophilia. Their blood factor is their largest piece of cost, and that isn't going to be influenced much by well-managed. So you're still going to get that large cost. So we used a number of about 11.2 for that population. We then looked at the expansion population, which looks a lot like Oregon Standard. And for that population, again, there's a little bit more chronic disease in that population that should really respond well to a well-managed system. And so we treated them like we did pregnant women and children and used the same type of factors that Milliman used on that population. We also then looked at the duals, which are people who are insured by both Medicare and Medicaid. And in that population, we actually took a look at a Lewin study that said bringing those two together should yield a savings of about 8.5%. We believe that's primarily on the Medicare side, and so it would take an agreement with Medicare to bring those costs down. So those were kind of the pieces. Then we took another look at the other things that you're doing in Oregon in terms of your transformation. One of those things, one of the critical things, is integration of physical and mental health. And so when we looked at that, we looked at some studies that showed that the savings there opportunity is 20 to 40% on, again, the age, blind, and disabled population, which is a smaller part of your population, but is the most expensive part. And so we took a look at that. We also know, based on our experience, that there is a lot of mental health that gets done in primary care offices and physical health costs that are related to mental health that are related to other parts of the population, both related to the pregnant women and the children's population, but also, again, to the what are going to be the expansion populations. And so we felt that a number of 10 to 20% was reasonable in terms of additional savings that are going to be available once you integrate that type of activity. Then we looked at your mental health preferred drug list, and there was an opportunity by implementing that to save $16 million over a biennium. We did not put that in the first year, as we knew that was going to take legislative action, and so that was something that would be out into the future. We also looked at primary care health homes. That is something we know you're working on. We know you have about 89 providers that you're currently evaluating for certification. And the literature there shows 4 to 9% as a savings factor. And in some cases, there were some studies that were a little bit higher than that. We do think this is kind of the backbone of a well-managed system, and it is critical in terms of patient satisfaction, quality, everything else. And so we downgraded a little bit. We said 4 to 7% would be where we would think this would fall, and so we added savings for that. We also looked at program integrity, and by that, we did not think that you needed to have additional audits, but we did think there's always some phantom costs in the way things are coded and the way things are done. And we believe the CCOs will be able to pull that cost out of the system. And finally, we basically said there's some administrative savings from just reducing the number of MCOs covering the same population. And that's a number. It's a smaller number, but it's in there. Then we talked about implementation, and we said, you know, there is an in the first biennium, which is really this next year, we said the opportunity would be 10 to 20% of the total is all that would really be available, we thought, in that first year. Now, we do think that some people have already started on these things, and they may do better than that, but we felt in total this is where we would end up. So then the next biennium, we said 40 to 50%, and then finally bringing it in full. We also want everyone to understand that we believe these savings are net amounts, that that's what the study showed us, and that we're pretty comfortable with that. We did exclude one type of savings that we believe is going on, but we couldn't justify it based on the net, and that is connectivity, which is certain of the IT strategies that are going in. That we looked at one Oregon study that said it was a 4-to-1 return on investment, which we believe is probably pretty accurate. But even at 4-to-1, the problem is if the Medicaid system is the has to bear the entire cost, it will not be able to generate enough savings to cover those costs. So that left us with a negative number, so we pulled that out and did not include that in our work. We want to make sure that everyone understands also that we're not trying to say this will be easy for the health system. This is a major transformation. This is not tweaking the system, and so we know that it will take a lot of effort, but we think it's very possible. The numbers were very large, so we tried to do two smell tests. The first smell test is really just looking at not just literature, but discussions have been going on for years, and consistently the healthcare system, the numbers we've always heard is there's 20 to 30% waste in the system. Well, our numbers through from the beginning to 2019 came up to a little over 25% and 39%. So we were within the ballpark of what has been often quoted, but no one has ever written down. The other thing we note in that is by taking costs out, you don't then continue to inflate those costs that you've been able to take out of the system. So that also contributed to those numbers. Finally, we took a look at a per member per month number, and we did a comparison to say, well, what are we really saying we're going to be taking out of the system? And there again, these are averages, so they're not scientific. But if you take a look in 2010, you were spending about $365 per member per month for the people that you covered. In 2013, that would grow to $394 in our model. We believe the low savings number represents $374, or a $20 per member per month savings. And the high savings number was $355, which is a $39 per member per month savings. So from that perspective, we said, well, those are not easy to achieve, but they're achievable. Those are not outrageous numbers. And we looked out again and said, and this we did on a more per member per year, we said, you know what, the cost would have grown from that from just under $4,400 in 2010 on a per year basis to a little over $6,100 if nothing was done in 2019. We're saying that if you, on the low savings side, you'd be right around $4,560 a year. Excuse me, on the high savings side, just under $3,700. So again, particularly the low savings number at $4,560 is actually almost $300 more than where you're at today. So we believe these numbers are, again, not the easiest to achieve, but absolutely possible. And we, are very, quite frankly, impressed, because the effort that you're making in transformation is to remove a lot of barriers that have kept the health system, I think, from moving forward and usually doing tweaks instead of transformation. And for the first time, you're actually going to allow people to work up to their license, as opposed to what historically has happened is everyone could work up to their billable license. And there's a significant difference between those two things. I'll entertain any questions.
Well, I'm impressed with the numbers, because everyone said that it was pie in the sky when we were talking about numbers last session, and to get an independent group, it's significant. So how much did you say it was total then, savings to the system?
In the first year, it's between $155 and $308 million, but by 2019, the number is between $2.2 billion. got too many numbers on my pages here. Hold on one second.
The first year you said it was 155 to 308
million.
Yes.
Million. And then 2019, 2.2 billion.
Let me make sure I've got the right number here. Yes, actually it's almost 3 billion in for the biennium. The 717 to 619, it's almost 3 million on the low end and 4.6 million on the high end.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very impressive report. One question for you. I think I may have asked this when we met in my office, but my assumption is that emergency department utilization and efforts to decrease that in an appropriate manner would go under improved to a well-managed system of care. Is that correct?
You know, it would. You know, that one is going to go across a number. It is going to absolutely be in the well-managed system of care. That's a big driver there. It is also an area that, as you improve your health homes, they'll have an additional effect on that. And also integrating your behavioral and physical health has an additional effect on that. Most everything, when you look at it, is going to come down to a couple things. There are pretty significant reductions in ER utilization and in admissions that can be prevented. And so those are the two costliest things you do, and they're the two areas that have the biggest reductions.
Great. Thank you very much.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in all due respect, thank you for your work. When I see statistics, I don't necessarily believe them. Quite honestly, and I know you had nothing to do with the original projection that we based our budget on in savings and transformation that have evaporated in smoke, and now we're being presented with a whole bunch of other savings that are based on assumptions of what happens in a static model, which always does bother me. Can you share with the committee where all these changes have happened at any one time and what the impacts have been?
I will tell you that there is no place where all these changes have happened at entirely one time. And I think that without what you're doing, the level of savings we're talking about here would be impossible. One of the things that you're doing that I think is among the most important is you're taking away the potential for the antitrust activity, because some of what needs to happen is providers being able to sit down and really work through these situations and determine how they deliver the best quality care at lower cost. And that has not been possible almost anywhere in the country. And this is the first place I've seen where a state has attempted to get very involved and make that possible. So these are based on our best professional judgment, based on looking at a lot of different things in different places. But I will be perfectly honest, no, we have not seen all of these things happen simultaneously anywhere.
Yeah, follow up.
Yes.
I could. No, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I've heard conflicting reports on the medical home models. In some places they're working, some places they aren't showing a whole lot of savings. And I think part of the problem here is the dynamics, and like at a CCO level, who the CEO of the CCO is going to have a huge impact on its efficiency, quite honestly. And I guess I'm just... I'm a little concerned. You do tend to target hospitals as a real place for savings, where actually we have a relatively low utilization level relative to other states. So I'm not sure that that's necessarily the big ticket. It could be maybe in a different state. But like I said, you know, these are impressive numbers, but we do this a lot, and we assume a static universe and make changes and assume human behavior. And in this, we're talking about a lot of human behavior, and so I guess I would have to say I'm not necessarily as optimistic as you are about your numbers.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was interested in one of the comments by Senator Cruz that we have lower ED utilization in our state than others. Do you have that information handy, or do we know where that came from? I'd be interested in seeing it.
I can get that. for you. I don't have it right here, but I can get that for you.
All right.
I can too.
Thank you.
No further questions?
Okay. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I think I heard a chime on the telephone, so I believe that was hopefully one of our consultants from Boston joining us. We have three individuals, one here in the room, Dr. Bill Wright from Providence Health System, and then on the phone, Dr. Alan Kachalia and Dr. Kate Baker from the Harvard School of Public Health. And these individuals are going to walk us through two things. One is a study that quantifies some of the costs of defensive medicine. That was one of the deliverables we were asked to bring forward. And secondly, you know, some recommendations around system reform. So I'm going to ask that Dr. Wright come up here and join us, and he'll introduce himself, and then on the phone we have Drs. Kachalia and Baker.
Chair Melissa Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for having us. Again, I'm Dr. Bill Wright. I'm with Providence Health System, Center for Outcomes Research and Education. My colleague on the phone is Kate Baker from the Harvard School of Public Health. And we were asked to produce a study of defensive medicine in Oregon. And there were really two key things that we were asked to do. First of all, produce an estimate of how much cost is attributable to defensive medicine, both across the economy as a whole, and then also the bottom line impact on the state budget. And then secondly, to come up with some estimates about overutilization and unnecessary care, and to figure out what the key drivers of cost associated with that unnecessary care are. And so I think Dr. Baker can walk you through our basic approach to producing the cost estimates, and then I'll do the same thing on the overutilization and unnecessary care side, and then we can wrap up with questions after that. Okay, did you want to go ahead and highlight?
Great, thanks, Bill. Can you all hear me all right?
Yes, and yes, thank you for being with us. Please introduce yourself and tell us who you are. And proceed.
I'm Kate Baker. I'm a professor of health economics at Harvard School of Public Health, and I was very pleased to work with Bill on this study. And the component that I'd like to talk with you about is estimating the degree of defensive medicine in Oregon and how much of the healthcare spending in Oregon can be attributed to excess use of tests and procedures because of fears of exposure to medical malpractice liability. Now, that's a hard question to answer because if you look at orders for tests or procedures in the hospital, they don't come labeled with a sign that says, I only did this because I was afraid of being sued. It's much harder to infer what share of spending is appropriate versus what share wouldn't have been done in the absence of those fears about malpractice. So to do that, we did two things. First, we drew from a broad literature that's tried to answer this very question, what share of medicine can be attributed to defensive medicine, using the best statistical techniques available. And that requires some more sophisticated statistical analysis than just saying, gee, do states with liability caps spend more or less than states without them? Because there are lots of reasons that spending in those states might differ besides just the liability caps. So it would be an incorrect inference in some cases to say that the liability caps or other defensive medicine protections are things that are driving the differences in spending. So we tried to cull the studies and find some of the most sophisticated estimates, which suggested that about 5% of hospital spending and a little under 2% of physician spending could be attributed to care that wouldn't have been delivered in the absence of fear about malpractice. And then we took those estimates and we applied them to Oregon-specific spending patterns, drawing on data compiled by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on spending by category, by insurer type in different states. So we had available spending not only for Oregon in specific, but for Medicaid, Medicare, SCHIP, other public spending, and private spending on hospitals, physicians, pharmaceuticals, and other categories of care in Oregon. So applying those estimates of the share of medicine attributable to the liability system to that Oregon-specific spending, we came to the conclusion that about $650 million of healthcare spending in Oregon overall can be attributed to the medical liability exposure faced by practitioners there, but that the vast majority of that is not spent through the Oregon state budget. Only about $30 million can be attributed to Oregon spending on Medicaid and SCHIP, with over $160 million attributed to the Medicare program, and then $340 million roughly attributed to private sector spending. So of the $650 that's spent on defensive medicine potentially in Oregon overall, about $30 million is showing up in the state budget. Now, Dr. Cataglia will talk much more about the way in which medical malpractice liability reforms might operate in the state. You can't think of that entire $30 million being up for grabs, because only some share of it would be reduced by the reforms that you're talking about, and I think Dr. Cataglia will speak in more detail to that. Now, there's some caveats. It's not obvious that the estimates from the literature apply directly to the Medicaid population in Oregon in particular, so there's got to be some uncertainty associated with that, and in part for that reason, the survey that Dr. Wright is going to describe provides a great complement, where he went out and asked providers in Oregon how their practice patterns mapped up to the findings that we see here, and he'll tell you about that.
Okay, thanks, Kate. So we tried to essentially approach this question using two completely different and distinct methodologies. So there was the analysis of the expenditures data, and then we used a survey of providers to try to come at it from a different direction. And what we wanted to do here was produce some estimates about overutilization and unnecessary care, try to come up with a way to attach some costs to that unnecessary care, and then see if we end up with anything that looks similar to the other approach that Kate just described with the expenditures data. And the way that we produced our estimates of unnecessary care was really, we started out, again, by going to the literature, and we looked for the types of procedures and tests that are most commonly associated with defensive practice or with unnecessary care and overutilization in that literature. Came up with a list, and then within the context of our survey, we presented that list to physicians in Oregon. And what we asked them to do for each of those items was to look at the item and tell us in their last month of practice how many orders for that they had placed, and then to use their best judgment to tell us how many of those orders were medically unnecessary. And what that enabled us to do, based on what the provider was reporting about their own ordering behavior, was to come up with an estimate of the total number of orders for each thing annually across all providers in Oregon, and then to come up with an estimate of the total number of unnecessary orders for each thing, and multiply that by the average cost of each thing, and you end up with a bucket of money that it represents how much is being spent on unnecessary care under each type of procedure. So how much is being spent annually on unnecessary x-rays, unnecessary CT scans, et cetera, et cetera. Yes. And we, please.
I'm just curious the level of confidence you had in the fact that a doctor would report that he was ordering unnecessary tests.
That was a real concern for us, Senator Cruz. And what we actually tried to implement a couple of ideas and embed something into our survey to assess that, because I think one of the things that you hear a lot about surveys is, and is a fair criticism, is that they're very subjective, and that the context that you present a question in or the way you frame a question can have a really big impact on the kind of findings that you get. And so in a fair question or criticism of a survey about defensive medicine is going to be, does this represent a real level of unnecessary care and overutilization that's actually happening, or is this filtered through the lens of how salient the issue is for the physicians who filled out your survey? The way we approached that in our work was to embed an experiment into our survey design, and that experiment was very simple. First of all, we had a survey about defensive medicine. We asked lots of questions about defensive medicine, and then on that survey, we have the set of questions that I just described about assessing overutilization. At the same time, we had another survey, which was a cost-effectiveness and healthcare survey that doesn't mention defensive medicine as an issue and doesn't frame the questions in that context, but includes that same set of overutilization questions. And then within our sample of physicians, we randomized which of those surveys physicians received. The point of that being that if you ask the same question in two completely distinct contexts, and as a group, physicians who fill out one survey report answers that look similar to the physicians that filled out the other survey, then you can be pretty confident that you haven't just captured a framing effect of the issue itself, and that you've maybe captured something that actually represents an underlying level of overutilization that actually exists. And so we essentially took the same questions, presented them in two completely distinct contexts, and then compared the results. What we found when we did that was that using this count-based approach to estimating overutilization, we got really reliable numbers across both groups of survey of physicians. So no matter which version they filled out, they gave us almost identical estimates of overutilization. That wasn't true for every type of question on the survey. There's some questions on those surveys that used more subjective scales or different approaches, and we did see some framing effects on those questions. So what that tells me is that our experiment was sensitive enough to capture the sort of effects of framing and the salience of the issue on responses, but that this particular approach that we used to produce these estimates gave us pretty scientifically reliable estimates. So I think there's always some criticism about the potential for subjectivity in surveys, but I think we took every step we could to try to make sure that we were capturing something that looked like the real rate of overutilization and not just a survey framing effect.
Chair Mons Anderson?
Yes.
Did I ask a question here?
Yes, please.
I don't know if you can hear me or not.
Yes, we can, loud and clear.
Okay. I appreciated Senator Cruz's question. It's a tough one to answer on either side. And I'm not sure how accurate it can be, but I appreciate what you tried to do. The other question I have is, who were the physicians they asked? By that I mean, were there primary care people outside the hospital setting, people inside the hospital setting? And also, we have three rather broad groups of physicians. One group is at OHSU under a specific tort system that's different from the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people in the FQHCs and in the veterans system that are on a completely different system of tort. So it might be quite different amongst those three groups of how they perceive or their fear of being sued and what their answers might be. I'd like to hear what the breakdown was there, if I could say. I'll go back and need to hear it.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I appreciate the question, and to answer first of all about which physicians were surveyed, we started with a list of using licensing data of every active physician in Oregon. We drew a sample that represented all of those physicians. We did do some oversampling because the literature suggested that certain types of specialties were particularly at risk for defensive practice or more susceptible to defensive practice. We wanted to make sure we had enough numbers within those subspecialties that we could compare or evaluate the role that specialty type played in as a driver of defensive practice among physicians. We did survey broadly across all types, including primary care physicians, hospital physicians. The other groups you mentioned, we had physicians at the VA. We had physicians everywhere in the state. So we didn't discriminate or select based on those criteria. We only oversampled in a few instances to ensure that we had enough, for example, emergency room physicians so that we could assess the particular role of some of those high-risk specialties on overutilization. We also did analyze the differences in their full report between physicians, say, at OHSU who have the tort claims coverage against physicians who didn't, and found some indications of some differences in patterns of overutilization based on that, that are described more fully in the report. I think it's a little bit difficult to attribute some of the some reasons behind those differences. For instance, physicians practicing at OHSU and the VA were a little bit less likely to report overutilization of hospital care in our data. But on the other hand, it's hard to know if that's a function of tort claims coverage or if it's just a function of the culture of those particular institutions or the connectivity they have to the hospital system that they work at. And so I think you'd have to design a study a little bit differently to try to get at the causality behind those questions. But those types of analyses were definitely included in our work.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. One, you talk about physicians, I assume nurse practitioners were not, even though they have an independent scope of practice, were not engaged in the survey?
We surveyed physicians.
Okay. Yep. And then secondly, Madam Chair, if I could, I brought up at the last meeting some research by a researcher named Burke, who in the American Journal of Genealogy or something like that, came to the finding that there was an association between whether or not the physician owned the imaging equipment and whether or not they engaged in, quote, defensive medicine or overutilization. Did you look at that issue at all?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Shields, that wasn't an issue that was particularly embedded into our survey, and We did talk about that a little bit at the last meeting that you mentioned, but by the time that conversation was happening, our survey was already in the field, and we weren't really able to implement the kind of design changes that it would take to get at that issue. I do recognize that that is an important issue. I think it's a little bit distinct from the scope of work around attributing defensive medicine, because I think that that sort of referral pattern behavior may exist in the presence or absence of defensive medicine, but I definitely recognize that that's an important issue that we were not able to address as part of this particular work.
Thank you. Can I make one final comment? So I did take a look about the Stark Law and related limitations of part. I think obviously that's a first part of it, and it's not the full analysis of how the Stark Law interacts with this. So I assume that work will continue, and I would just encourage us to be cautious, because I think what's important is the overutilization question is interesting, but why they're doing the overutilization is, to me, the more important question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Just to finish up then, I appreciate that, Senator Shields, and we try to get at, in our full report, we try to do a little bit of statistical modeling to understand what the key drivers associated with overutilization are, but unfortunately, as I mentioned, we weren't able to sort of capture those financial relationships and the role those played in driving overutilization as part of this particular study. The last thing I'll say in terms of my confidence in the estimates that we produced for this study, in addition to the experiment that we embedded within our survey, the other thing I really like about the results that we came up with is the consistency that exists across the two methods that we used.
We can hear someone talking on the phone.
That may be me. I wanted to ask another question, so I went off mute. I'm not talking. This may be background noise. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
I'll go back to mute and let me have a chance to ask a question.
Okay.
All right, I'll just wrap up very briefly then. I just wanted to point out that when we used our survey estimates and then attached our cost numbers to those survey estimates and then rolled those up into a global cost figure on the cost of defensive of overutilization, and then compare that estimates that were produced using that method to the estimates that came out of the work Kate was describing with expenditures data, we get extraordinarily similar results. I know, you know, one of them is $650 million and one $745 million, but within the context of $26 billion in spending, they're within 0.5% of each other. And I think whenever that happens, as a scientist, I think it just improves your confidence that you're probably looking at something that's in the right ballpark as an answer. And so between that and the experiment that we embedded, I think we have a pretty fair amount of confidence that we're producing something that is relatively reasonable. There's always a chance that you're not asking the exact right questions and you're missing something, but I feel pretty comfortable in the numbers that we have because of that reason.
Okay, Senator Bates, go ahead.
I'm sorry for the background. There's a couple of issues that I'd like to have more information on, if they've got the information. If not, we can get it later. I don't know if there's any comparisons been done in places like they looked at, in places like Texas, where they went through major tort reform, and did they see any significant change in the practices of physicians broadly in the state. Also, I know at least one study recently done in western Pennsylvania with orthopedists compared the practices of physicians who had been sued or knew somebody who had been sued compared to those who didn't. And there was a dramatic change there in utilization also. Pretty obvious cause and effect in that case, at least. I don't know if they had a chance to look at any of that or if they know about it. If not, we can talk about it later, and I'm going to go back on mute for you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator Bates, I think that's going to be a great question also for Dr.
Kachalia. Just a minute. Yes, Dr. Baker?
Great, thank you. Just a quick answer in terms of looking at other states. For the first part of the analysis, where we looked at estimates of the increase in healthcare use when there was increased medical malpractice liability pressure, those estimates are drawn from comparisons of other states like Texas, where you look at a state that implemented a change in law compared to a state that didn't implement the change in law. So the estimate really comes from across states so that you can say, this looks like it isolates the effect of the law change versus saying, you know, Texas is just different from Oregon or from Pennsylvania. So if you look at one state in isolation, it's very hard to know what's the effect of a particular law in place because so many other laws are different too. So the strategy really relies on changes in laws in some states compared to other states that you regard as a comparison group because they didn't have a law change. And that's where the 5% of hospital spending and 2% of physician spending that I mentioned before come from, but not from one state in particular.
And Dr. Goldberg?
Well, I was just going to say, Dr. Kachalia might also want to address that during his remarks. I know he's listening.
Okay. Dr. Cataldi, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Why don't you introduce...
Everybody hear me?
Yeah. Should we have you, Dr. Wright, finish or let him start?
I'm finished unless there's further questions, Chair Monis-Anderson.
Why don't you go ahead then, Dr. Cataldi?
Okay, well, I'll go ahead and start. So, hello, my name is Alan Cataldi. I'm a physician here at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and it's a privilege to be speaking to you today. So what I'll do is I'll briefly review a report that Professor Michelle Mello and I were asked to prepare on five tort reforms that Oregon is considering. Professor Mello is a professor and a researcher at the Harvard School of Public Health, and she and I are both attorneys. So the focus of the transformation initiative that Oregon's considering is, as we understand it, one of the focuses is cost containment. So as we consider medical liability reforms, there are about two routes through which reform might help with cost containment. The first is reducing defensive medicine, so that way you reduce utilization of unnecessary services. And the second is that by creating conditions for insurers to reduce malpractice premiums, the hope is that these savings will then be passed along to providers, who in turn will pass them along to patients in the form of lower prices for health services. So that mentioned, we were asked to look at five reforms. The first one was non-economic damages caps. The second was use of medical panels, also known as pretrial screening panels. The third is extending OTCA coverage to providers when they participate in CCOs, when they're caring for Medicaid patients who are in CCOs. That's right. And then the fourth is modifying Oregon's joint and several liability statute. And the fifth is an administrative compensation system. We based our findings on empirical studies that have been conducted, as well as data on Oregon malpractice claims and malpractice insurance premiums. So again, which direction Oregon goes with regard to these reforms depends on what Oregon's primary objective will be. If the focus is only on healthcare cost containment, caps of the five that we reviewed, caps are probably the most promising reform. However, we concluded the effects of caps will be fairly modest and would involve certain inequities. So here what I'll do is I'll briefly review the evidence on caps as to what we learned. So studies in general have shown that caps can have statistically significant effects on reducing indemnity payments, malpractice insurance premiums, and physician supply in rural areas. But the effects of these sizes are very small. We actually believe the effect in Oregon will be even smaller than the national average, because Oregon already has some caps in place, with notably being the OTCA and the $500,000 cap for wrongful death, prenatal, and birth injuries. As a result, we project that there would be modest savings from a cap on indemnity payments on the average of about, estimate of about $15 to $32 million over 5 years. And we must remember that the savings on these premiums come at a cost, because these caps will disproportionately burden the most severely injured and the elderly. It's also unclear how long it would take for these indemnity payment savings that insurers would see to be passed along to providers and passed along to patients. So if I move on to the next three tort reforms, we asked to evaluate that was medical panels.
There's a lot. I don't know, Dr. Bates, if you've muted, but there's...
I'm muted. It's not me.
Okay. All right. Whatever it was, it went away. Go ahead, Dr. Cataldi.
Okay, no problem. So we concluded that medical panels, OTCA reform, and joint and several liability reform are probably not promising as cost containment mechanisms. Now, quickly review why. So for panels, it turns out studies quite uniformly find that they're not effective in reducing, they have not been effective in reducing liability costs, the amount of claims that we see, and affecting other key liability-related outcomes. There has been one study, however, that did find a small effect with regard to reducing defensive medicine practices in OB. For the third reform, which was OTCA coverage extension, it turns out when you analyze it, it may save some money for insurers, but they may not be able to pass these savings on to providers. And this is because it may be actuarially very difficult for them to figure out how to reprice insurance, given that a reform would affect only some of a provider's patients. And this proportion is going to be difficult for them to estimate and may change over time, because the amount of Medicaid patients covered by this in a CCO that go in and out of a provider's panel may change. So it would be very difficult for insurers to predict this. So this is why, this is a, the reason why we also predicted OTC reform won't decrease defensive medicine, because most of our providers' patients won't be, won't fall under this OTCA protection. We also need to keep in mind that OTC extension will involve additional investment from the state in terms of providing additional liability coverage, but it's likely only to cover a small number of claims. But before I move on to the fourth reform here, I should mention that this OTCA analysis was done only when providers were taking care of Medicaid patients that were enrolled in a CCL. So you had to be taking care of a Medicaid patient in a CCL, not just if you had a, if you participated in the CCO and you received general protection. For the fourth reform, joint and several liability reform, we estimate that the benefits will be very limited because as it currently stands, very few claims in Oregon settle in excess of a provider's typical policy limits. There were only about 34 claims over 5 years in the National Practitioner Data Bank, which this data bank has only claims against individuals that, that excludes claims against institutions. But again, this is a very, very small number. Moving on to the fifth reform here, so if Oregon's focus is broader than cost containment alone, and Oregon's seeking to improve the liability system's performance and improve contributions to safety, an administrative compensation system is probably the most promising option of the five. The first four reforms actually don't address all the fundamental performance issues with the system. They don't address all of them. Notably, they don't address system overhead issues or patient access to compensation. Now, an ACS is not likely to be cost-saving in terms of direct liability costs because it may actually open up the ability for patients to access compensation better, but it may well actually reduce defensive medicine costs by creating a better just culture here. System liability costs, however, may still be controllable in ACS through various design decisions, such as limiting what types of damages and the amount of damages that may be allowable. And ACS may also carry other benefits, such as more quickly resolving claims and compensating patients, giving better patients better access to compensation, reducing the adversarialism that currently exists, removing the stigmatization of providers that can come with a claim, and give much better information on learning about how to improve patient safety. But again, at the end of the day, though, an ACS will have large political and legal challenges before it can be implemented. And with that, I'll stop for questions.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a clarification. Your study was on providers, not institutions, correct?
That is correct. We focused mostly on providers. That is correct.
Okay. So if you included institutions, hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and the like, it would probably change what you came up with, correct?
Yes. Depending on what reform you're talking about, yes. So when you're talking about things like medical panels, it probably wouldn't change our findings because if you look at the evidence, there's not a lot of difference. They don't seem to affect the legal variables. But when you look at the effects of CAPS or if you look at the effects of OTCA coverage and apply it differently, yes, you could have different conclusions.
Okay, thank you. And just another clarification, you did state it, but when you were looking at OTCA, you were just looking at the Medicaid portion of a provider's book of business, not his whole book of business. And so when you get to the raw numbers, that would dramatically, if we're doing the whole book of business, that dramatically changes those numbers, doesn't it?
It could, but if you start, basically what happened, and we clarified what we've been asked to look at, so we really did just look at not just Medicaid patients, but you had to be a Medicaid patient participating in a CCO,
right.
And that's when the provider got the OTCA coverage. If you start extending this protection to, let's say you've got a provider who takes care of Medicaid patients and you provide them OTCA protection for every patient they take care of, that basically would be turning the state into an insurer in some regards for that provider, moving the state, into the insurance business. And when you look at the effects there, that may help a provider, there's no question with regard to the liability pieces of it. It may also help a provider concerns around going through a lawsuit because that's the second thing that they worry about. However, the third issue, which is what happens with claims-related reporting, which is something else that gives providers concern, would still need to be addressed.
I might suggest that there would not be a burden on the state financially if, for example, the CCO in their structure was the repository of the liability insurance and all the providers in the network were contributing to it, and that was where the umbrella was. So it wouldn't be state funds. It would basically be what the providers are already contributing, only maybe less. And according to the OTCA, they would still be accountable as far as they could be named, and they would still go into the reporting system. So I don't think we would want to change that. But having said that, if we go to this sort of model, clearly the JSL no longer is in play at all.
And the JSL is?
Joint Several Liability. Mm-hmm. You know, just simple country boy.
Yeah, right.
JSL, all right.
I feel this may be a little bit more complicated than meets the eye, then, if from what you have said, Senator Cruz. It was my idea that the state would then be held liable, but you're saying your idea is for the CCO to be held liable, and I'm not sure a CCO would want to do that.
Madam Chair, it depends. Once again, we're getting down to what is the structure of a CCO and what does this umbrella organization, which a CCO, in my vision, actually becomes, what is its function, and where, we get into the risk assessment, we get into all these other pieces that fit there. Eventually, it has to rise to a kind of a community sort of level, and my vision is it's at the CCO level. We're not burdening the state.
Dr. Bates, do you have any questions?
No questions at the moment. I'm sorry for the background noise.
That's okay.
I'm still concerned about we're picking up a puppy here.
is that your purebred German Shepherd?
That's a German Shepherd. You can hear already. I mean, I'll take this real quick. I am concerned that the study is interesting, but it doesn't go deep enough to really look at what we needed to get to. And they only had a couple of months to do it, and I appreciate that also. I also know that from my first experience in the position, the numbers were being given about, whether or not we practice defensive medicine at what level. I think they're underrating it. I think it's part of the subjective requirement that, what do you, doctor, do you do this? No, I don't, sort of thing. So I think there's lots of questions here yet. I think there's a lot more money on the table than we think there is in defensive medicine. But I'll look to study more closely at the main page. This show have that chance to the whole study yet. I just think we need a lot more questions on this before we come to conclusion of the best thing to do. And I particularly like the point that Senator Cruz has brought up. I think he's got fine ideas and most of the things on.
Thank you, Dr. Bates. Any other further questions? Thank you very much. I am now learning more about MedMal than I ever had wanted to in the past. But I am surprised at the modest savings from the report.
Madam Chair, what you get, it depends on what questions are asked. And I'm not sure, and not that it's anybody's fault, because there's different ideas that have come up since all of this started. And so the questions on the full meal deal, as I like to call it, weren't asked because it wasn't on the table at the time.
Okay, do you have any final comments?
None.
All right. For your information, we'll probably hear this bill. We'll have informational hearings on all bills but transformation on February 1st, and then we will hear transformation on February 3rd, and then how it goes. I want to be moving the bill the following week. So all of these problems need to be ironed out by the board that you will address, because we don't really have time for amendments and we don't have time to ask for fiscals. And so thank you very much.
We've got a busy 2 weeks ahead of us.
Yes.
We'll be ready.
All right.
We'll be on it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right. Yes. Yes, Dr. Kachalia and Kate Baker, and thank you very much for joining us. It was a very, very informative.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here.
All right. Thank you.
And Doug, are you still on the phone?
I am.
Great. Okay. Now what will
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now I'd like to move on to invited testimony, and the reason that I did this is because all of a sudden we're finding out about all these things that are sort of related to transformation. So I may have excluded some people, but these were people that came to me to talk about their concerns or what they are doing, not necessarily concerns. So will the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative please come forward? I'm not sure which of you want to be here. I see Greg Van Pelt and Cindy Becker and Dave Ford and Ed Blackburn. So whoever wants to take the seats, please introduce yourself and proceed. And Senator Shields has to leave at 3, so if you have specific concerns that you would want to bring forward before you have to leave, that'd be great.
Yep. Ready? Thank you. I'm Greg Van Pelt. I'm the Chief Executive for Providence Health and Services. I'll start and then share the presentation with my colleagues. As many of you know, why we're doing this is our current system is fragmented, inefficient, and difficult to navigate. We hope to accomplish a unified regional system of integrated care that addresses medical, dental, behavioral, mental health, and addictions. Social service needs of the citizens of our community. We want to find ways to make the risk and the responsibility equitable by having all stakeholders commit either dollars or services to this effort. We came together as a group of private and public organizations addressing a single complicated question: can we together improve the quality of care and the care experience of Medicaid members and high-risk uninsured citizens and do it for less than we currently spend? Our group includes many competitors, but we're talking about how we might do this together and what it might look like. We are still in our early days, and there's a lot yet we don't know. There are questions of the nature of the ultimate organization, how revenue streams work, and many more complex issues. How we got started, we formed an executive steering committee composed of representatives from CARE Oregon, Oregon Health Sciences University, Legacy, Providence, Kaiser Permanente, the Metro Area Community Health Centers, and Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington Counties. We have just added quality health care and family care to our executive steering committee. These organizations, in essence, provided the large majority of care to the present Medicaid and uninsured population. And we think of ourselves as growing in concentric circles as to our work as it continues. We have broken the actual work into several streams: model of care, revenue development and distribution, startup development, and communications. Our group has applied for a $30 million grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovations that will help us develop the model, though we are committed to moving forward even if unsuccessful in receiving the grant. Let me give you a quick sense of this as to the progress that we have made and the level of collaboration that has occurred over the past 4 weeks. All the aforementioned groups are meeting weekly, and the grant application is on track for submission by January 27th. We received reports back from studies that we had conducted on December 6th, and we had, in essence, 11 days for the groups to come together and submit letters of intent for the grant, and thus the reason for us to move quickly and effectively as a steering committee. So, in essence, we've been at work over the Christmas holidays and New Year's holidays for 3 weeks to get this work started. We've had dedicated and often difficult decisions among diverse and historically competitive organizations to set us on the path to developing nothing less than a transformation of the care of the Medicaid and high-risk population in the Tri-County area, which account for about half of all Oregon Medicaid expenditures and will, at the not-too-distant future, include up to 300,000 citizens. We're only a few weeks old, and we have significant challenges with no roadmap to follow. There ultimately may be one CCO in the metro area, or there may be several. Frankly, it makes no difference to our work. We all know for certain at this point in time that doing nothing is not an option, and we're committing the resources and time to forging ahead. As I mentioned, this is a very diverse group.
We're pleased to be working with the counties, and I'd like to introduce Cindy Becker, who is the Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County. You know, I just want to say that a year ago, who'd have thought we'd be together at this table talking about this really extraordinary collaborative. I know there were lots of conversations about how is this going to work in rural counties, and it's a very different dynamic when you have one hospital and one mental health center. But when you're in the metro area, you've got five and six of everything. It's really quite an accomplishment to bring folks together who really do share a common direction. And so there, what I want to talk a little bit about is the diversity of the folks that have been involved to date. I also think it's important to remember we haven't been doing this for very long, and really a lot of the work that has gone on is in preparation for the grant that is due January 27th. And so the amount of time and effort that has been committed by all of these groups is really been incredible. And so if you'll indulge me, I do want to read the list for the record because I think it's really important. And these are the folks who have been involved in the work groups that have been putting the grant application together. So we have the Alliance of Culturally Specific Health Programs, the Asian Health Center Services Center, Care Oregon, Cascadia Behavioral Health, Central City Concern, Children's Health Alliance, Clackamas County, Coalition of Communities of Color, Coalition of Community Health Centers, DePaul Treatment Centers, Health Center of Oregon, Kaiser Permanente, Legacy Health, LifeWorks Northwest, Lutheran Community Services Northwest, Metro Area Community Health Centers, Multnomah County, Northwest Cardiovascular Institute, Oregon Center for Children and Youth with Special Health Needs, Oregon Community Health Information Network, Oregon Clinic, Oregon Department of Public Health, OHSU, Oregon Pediatric Improvement Partnership, OPCA, Primary Care Association, Providence Health and Services, Rosewood Family Health, I'm almost done, Tuolumne Healthcare, Virginia Garcia Health Center, Washington County, Western Psychological and Counseling Services, and we've had eight consumers also involved. I think, and all of these entities have had multiple people, and some of our committees we've had between 35 and 40 people trying to come around the table to develop, whether it's model of care, whether it's evaluation, all the different components. And so what we're trying to do is cast as wide a net as possible, but also do it in such a way that we could actually get the work done for the grant. But it's also laying the foundation for as we move forward as a collaborative entity. Now that the grant is due, as you know, next week, and as people are taking their breath, we have a communications work group that is focused on making sure that we have two-way communications with various stakeholders. We are going to be putting a group together that will be meeting on a regular basis that consists of behavioral health providers, business providers, communities of color, consumer groups, dental providers, educational institutions, advocacy groups, insurers, social service agencies, and primary care providers, among others. Then we also are going to cast an even wider net by making sure that we have regular email communications. We're developing a website. So, you know, we're trying to balance, you know, getting people at the table, making sure people have information. I know there's been concern expressed that there hasn't been a lot of information to date. But to be honest, as Greg said, this is pretty new and we've been scrambling, and there's all intent to get that wider group. And so we've had the initial circle of getting the grant in, and now we're saying, okay, let's talk about this. Let's make sure as we start moving now towards implementation of a CCO, let's make sure we're hearing from other people in two-way communication. So I think it's really, it's exciting, it's extraordinary, and we have great people at the table. So with that, I would like to introduce Ed Blackburn from Central City Concern, unless you have questions of me before I do that.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Cindy, I'm assuming at this point in time when I look at the list of organizations that there are others you're still probably going to be reaching out to, because I can think of some that aren't on this list. So,
Senator Cruz, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, absolutely. This was a list. It was like, okay, we got to get this grant in. Who do we need to touch base with? And now we're spreading it out to many more people. Absolutely.
Okay, and I good luck with trying to get actual products out of a 40-person group. I don't know how you do that, but
we have. I know, it's a miracle.
We did that Wednesday nights last year.
Yes, we did. Chair Monsanto-Sinden, Vice Chair Cruz. My name is Ed Blackburn. I'm the Executive Director for Central City Concern. Central City Concern has demonstrated over the years that by providing a comprehensive, coordinated care array of services for people who suffer from homelessness, serious mental illness and addictions, and long-term poverty, by doing that, you can have a very powerful intervention and reduce admissions and utilization of psych units, of state hospital, of hospitals, and emergency departments. This approach that's being promised now through the coordinated care organization has the potential of taking this model, not the model of Central City Concern, I should say, the idea, and expanding it across a tri-county area that could have a tremendous impact. We know it. We see it in our everyday experience. This is a very exciting effort. The primary vehicle for doing this on a community-based level is the integrated primary care home model. And I'm pleased to say that Central City Concern's Old Town Healthcare Clinic was the first clinic in Oregon to be designated by the Oregon Health Authority as a primary home model for healthcare. So we're very pleased to be part of this. And what I've seen over the period of the last 3 weeks of all these community organizations coming to the table, from very grassroots organizations through community health centers, through the hospital institutions in the counties, I've never seen anything in my 20 years that was this comprehensive and this opening in terms of welcoming people to the table to help developing something that's truly innovative and comprehensive. It is going to be a rocking and rolling thing, but we have faith and we have the determination to make something out of this. So I'm very pleased to be here. Thanks for listening to me, and I look forward to the next few months to see how this is developed. It's truly, truly fun at times.
At times.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Would it be possible, obviously, if you were the first designee, obviously there was an application process. Mm-hmm. Would it be possible for us to see copies, or do I need to go to Dr. Goldberg for that? I'd just like to know. I haven't seen the application.
Sure. Absolutely.
I mean,
no problem.
Just to help inform how they're making these decisions.
Absolutely. We will get a copy of our application to you. We can't get the
just
others.
Just get it to Sandy and she can.
Yeah. So I want to introduce the president and CEO of CARE Oregon, who is, over the years, the hospitals and CARE Oregon and the managed care companies have helped us put together this comprehensive coordinated care system we have at Central City Concern. We could not do it without the partners who are actually at the steering committee, including the counties. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and Vice Chair and Senator Shields. I'm Dave
Dr.
Ford
Bates
for the record. Pardon?
And Senator Bates on the phone.
And Senator Bates, excuse me.
He's on the phone. You can call him Alan, I think.
I'm David Ford, who's the CEO for CARE Oregon. Thank you for inviting us here. I'd like to echo what you've heard. The group that's working on this, you often hear groups drop to the lowest common denominator. That's quite not what's happening here. This group is operating at the highest common denominator. The challenges to be able to be flexible, to work on new things, is really stimulating some best creative talent in the community. And it's been exciting to be part of it. You'll hear more as the grant process goes forward. The pull that everyone has had is to make a difference for the people that are in our community, both a number of the uninsured on a selective basis, a high risk, as well as Medicaid. The precipitous drop that may happen, most probably will happen financially, has galvanized us, but the issue is we're looking at as an opportunity as well as not just looking at our own interests. We've each had a number of things. We've created divisions of labor. there will be people who, like Providence, that has led an effort around navigators in the emergency room. Legacy has done a lot of work around discharge planning so people don't come back into the hospital afterwards. We've done some work around primary care renewal over the years and invested millions of dollars in that and are seeing over a 10% return over that period of time. And it's remarkable to see all of that pooled into a common effort and being able to spread the technology that we're developing. And so what we're working on the grant is creating a shared process and a shared service organization to benefit the folks that we work with. We're sharing information. We'll need to, we've never been able to coordinate all the information about the patient so that we can do an integrated care work, as Ed has talked about. And that really creates an opportunity for us. We're looking at flexible governance on this. We haven't created the form yet. We're looking everything from a public corporation to contractual arrangements with 501c3. And if everything defaults, multiple CCOs. But that's not the fundamental effort that we're trying to create a commons. And we've actually called the grant the Tri-County Health Commons as a metaphor. On the forecasts that have been put forward, we need to really be sober about those. We have to invest forward. We're going to put up dollars among ourselves to, in addition to grant funding, most likely, to invest in infrastructure. We can't do this the way we were doing it. We call what we're doing today yestercare. We need to go through a transition, and we have to work through a model probably to create a future care. We don't exactly know what that is. It's still emergent. But there's a lot of work to be done, and it's not going to be something that happens overnight in terms of rapid savings. A lot of the early development will be in trial and error, although we're doing it on a broad scale. So with that, I'll close and leave open the opportunity for questions, and just like to say I'm really appreciative of the colleagues we have here and who are not in the room who have done a lot of work to try to respond to the legislative provocation that you've created.
As you probably know, there's a lot of angst amongst your group, I mean, from people outside with your group. But I'll defer to Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is to Greg. I would want to encourage you on in your pursuits. And I think what will help me get to yes on LC97 is if you expand the steering committee to other providers, including those in private practice, and continue to open up the process as you go along. And could you send the professional staff a copy of the minutes that have been of the meetings that have taken place? I think that would help us feel more comfortable sending the message to our constituents that it would reassure them, I think.
Yeah, I think that request has been heard. I know, I think you've talked to Dr. George Brown, our chair, and I will relay that message to George. I know he's been in touch with you. I should also, for Senator Cruz, the application that we're speaking of is the CMMI grant. That's due the 27th, and so as we finish that work, we're happy to share that with you. But I wanted to make sure that in terms of timing, it'll probably be closer to the first of the month when that work is completed.
That would be fine. Madam Chair, if I could, Cindy, you were around here when we were struggling trying to do mental health in the Tri-County. You remember that.
So I am really old.
Yeah, well, so am I. you can understand the trepidation as we view something of this scale, and also part of my trepidation would be that the larger an organization gets, the more sluggish its ability to react is. So that's when I look at the rest of the state, which is relatively simple compared to you guys. The economies of scale, I think, make them more, the ability to react is greater. And so that would be one concern I would have of something of this scale.
And if I could just mention something, Senator Cruz, the counties, even before the CCO's conversation last year, the three counties have been working together on standardizing processes, which is so, which has really helped, I think, in terms of coming to be part of this group, because then it's something that we all share in terms of making sure that we do have that, because, you know, we a lot of the providers cross the three counties, and we don't want to, you know, have people to have, you know, different experiences no matter where they go. So that piece that you're talking about is really critical.
Well, and that would be the downside of the other way is for providers to have to be members of multiple CCOs. And like I say, the rest of the state's easy. You guys are just a problem. I mean, it's just
great challenge.
That was a joke. Okay, come on.
Although I had a tour of LifeWorks in Gresham, and they were and they have a pharmacy there, and we were talking about CCOs, and even though they're not a part of your group, they are very excited about that concept of being a part of a CCO. They see 600 patients a month, and these are very severely mentally ill clients, and they already have a home, and what they envision now is having a medical provider coming into their clinic, and they just feel this will be so much better for their clients that they're seeing.
Madam Chair, this is the kind of work that is going on that we're all supporting. As an example, LifeWorks also now is being integrated into our clinics, so that, again, that it, to Ed's point, is bringing the providers of multiple agencies and organizations and competencies into a single place where our Medicaid and uninsured can receive that care. We are including, as an example, the Multnomah County Health Clinics in our network of providers. So this is though still fragile and early, but just the venue that we have is creating new relationships and new ways of doing things that we haven't done before. And this is why it's still so new that, as I say, and it's not a formal organization in Senator Shields, that's why it is, we're learning as we go. So it is going to take some patience. And this is why we think of this in these concentric circles, is just let's get some things started and learn and grow as we go.
Senator Shields, and then Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the question about the minutes, I've gotten some mixed messages. You know, George Brown said, no, I couldn't have the minutes. Multnomah County said, sure, we'll get you the minutes. So however you all decide, I'd appreciate it if you did respond to the professional staff in writing to let us know what your decision is going to be.
Thank you very much. Oh,
yeah, it's just I think these people may make a very valid point. I mean, we were told we had to. There's a real rush to conclusion in this process, and there can't be. And you guys are a perfect example. And quite honestly, there's a lot of the rest of the state that is just on the front end as well of trying to figure out what they want to become. And I think it would be a disservice to all of the good efforts you're doing for us to try to push you past where you can go in a competent way. So
thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to move on to the dental care organization. Just has a couple of minutes of sharing their concern, which they hope that the health authority will pay attention to.
Madam Chair, while they're getting set up here,
okay, and we do have Lori Freeman here, who's here to answer legislative intent on the question that you brought forward.
If I could, just on the record, and I should have done it while Bonetto and Goldberg were here, but if our capable staff could relay this message. We know that there's the one thing we didn't talk about was the $500 million carrot that's hanging out there.
Oh, yes.
What I would like to know on the front end is what strings CMS has attached to the $500 million. obviously, I mean, the money's supposed to flow through a CCO, theoretically, whatever that means, but what does CMS consider the organization has to look like for the money to flow?
Okay.
And I think it's very important that we know the federal requirements on that $500 million.
And just for the public, we have been told that if transformation passes, we will be will be receiving $500 million a year for the next
The governor said five years. I've been told that CMS has the first $500 million in pocket, but I would also suggest that at some point in time, Congress might actually pass a budget rather than just doing continuing resolutions, and that dynamic might change. So we can assume the first year. I don't think we can assume past that.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair Anderson, for taking the time in a busy schedule to see us. Also, thank you, Senator Shields, Senator Cruz, I guess, who just left, and Senator Bates, I believe, on the telephone. Since dentistry only represents about 5% of the total budget, and we're looking for efficiency, I'll try and keep my comments under 5% of your time.
Okay? And you did you state your name?
Steve Petrozelli. I'm sorry, I'm representing Willamette Dental. And to my left here is Doug Barber, who is our government relations consultant on this. Just some brief comments, and maybe we're a little paranoid, but I think you get that way. The Willamette Dental Group has been involved with the Medicaid and Oregon Health Program since its inception in about 1994. And since dentistry was never a mandated benefit, we're always a little nervous. So, and our specific area of concern really is on page 24 of the CCO implementation plan under 3650. And very briefly, I'll just read from this to keep it simple. The CCO implementation proposal states oral health by July 1, 2014 under HB 3650 requires each CCO to have a formal contractual relationship with any dental care organization that serves members of the CCO in the area where they reside. To maintain continuity of care for OHP patients, the implementation proposal should clarify that CCOs must contract with all DCOs in their service area. That's the crux. The word any does not necessarily mean all. And we believe the legislature, intended to mean that CCOs must contract with every DCO with members in the service area. And while I'm here today speaking on behalf of Willamette Dental, I think I can speak for at least a majority of the dental care organizations who share that concern. And those organizations probably treat about somewhere in the neighborhood of about 65% of all Medicaid patients who are receiving dental care through the dental care organizations and things. What we want to make sure is that in each one of the areas whether we wait until July 1 of 2014 or dental comes into some of the CCOs prior to that the Medicaid patients continue to have choice and continue to be able to see the providers they've come adjusted to in those geographic areas, and that no benefit is necessarily gained by any one DCO to the advantage of the others, and that we don't see a reduction in the total providers available in those geographic areas to service those patients and everything. The basic of my comments.
Lori Freeman, can you just come up and convey to us the word any, what any means in lawyer jargon? Statute jargon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lori Freeman, Office of Legislative Counsel. Give me just a second to get to that. This was this appeared in Section 4 of House Bill 3650, and it said, on or before July 1st, 2014, each coordinated care organization must have a formal contractual relationship with any dental care organization that, so it's any would be all, but then it's conditioned by that, serves members of the coordinated care organization in the area where they reside.
Okay.
So it would be any organization if the members of the coordinated care organization are being served by a particular DCO, then the CCO has to contract with that DCO.
So the Medicaid clients, Okay. Does that help?
I think that gives us the interpretation we thought was appropriate. We are sending a letter onto the Health Policy Board on this very subject also, and I hope it gets, hopefully would be changed in a simple word change in the final document.
Possible? I mean, you're, no, Lori Freeman.
Madam Chair, I think they're talking about the implementation proposal.
Oh, they're in the report. I see. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Steve, I'm going to look at dental organizations the same as I do counties, and having contractual relationships when you're a care provider, I think my and what this what's happening in Douglas County is Mike's at the table. So if you know what I mean. I mean, I still think anybody with risk should have a voice and not just a contractual relationship. But it's going to happen one way or another, I suppose.
Yeah, so. Certainly Mike Shercliffe and that organization does an excellent job down in the areas that they serve and everything, and I have a lot of confidence in Mike that he probably does a good job of representing dental care in general down there and everything. I just, the crux of the matter is to make sure that at the appropriate time, as we contract and come into the system and contract with the CCOs, that we, in fact, each DCO has the ability to contract directly with the CCO based on those that are operating the area, as long as they want to contract, continue to contract in that area for patient continuity and everything. And each model is a little different, and I think it's important that the CCO directly have discussions with each individual DCO to understand how that DCO operates and make sure they feel comfortable it will be in compliance with whatever standards are set up as to access and quality.
And I would also suggest by the end of the day, because I think there'll be some changes in the language on the non-discrimination section of that. We've been having conversations. We'll let you in on it at some point.
Are you taking minutes?
Yeah. And no, actually, we're not taking minutes because none of us can write. But but I would suggest that it's not what we're after is not only non-language that so we don't discriminate against types of providers, but providers within a type as well. So that may cover that as well.
I understand.
So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time again.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Dr. Goldberg's out in the hall, and he's kind of in a meeting and watching us, and he said he would love to come
okay,
in.
Okay, well, let's have the next panel. We only have one more.
Okay.
Building CCO networks. Let's have Sharon Fox from Children's Health Alliance, Jesse, and we'll call you. This is the last group. They're not going to take long because I told them they couldn't take long.
Madam Chair, I'm going to have to go pick up my daughter from childcare. It would be great if I could hear from Children's Health Alliance first, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay.
So I'm interested in their participation in the CCO
great.
Process so far. And then I'm afraid I'm going to have to leave, so don't take it personally.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm Sharon Fox from the Children's Health Alliance. And I want to say good afternoon, Senator or Chairwoman Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. On a personal note, I was driving down here and thinking I feel like I do when I vote. Very privileged to participate in the legislative process. So thank you for having me and thank you for inviting me. I am the CEO of Children's Health Alliance, and my physician directors would like to attend today. Given the short notice, they are seeing patients, so they were unable to do so, so I'm speaking on their behalf. We represent 126 primary care pediatricians, and I emphasize primary care. We have 25 sites that spread from Vancouver to Salem and Gresham to Newburgh. The cornerstone of our organization is quality improvement, and just to give you a brief example of some of the things we've been working on for the last 3 years, which we're very proud of, and that is implementation of standardized developmental screening and tools, and this resulted in a significant increase in referrals to early intervention. We have implemented a two-year-old immunization rate improvement project about 3 years ago, actually implemented 2 years ago, and we resulted in a 6% improvement interior immunization rates, and we worked with the Oregon Alert System to make sure that the registry is up to date for the state of Oregon. And it also resulted in a review of over 20,000 charts so far, two-year-olds. We also, in last 2 years ago, implemented the standardized asthma care guidelines for children. Our providers have identified 9,000 patients with asthma and have placed them in a registry where we track longitudinal care. And the ultimate outcome there is to reduce ER and hospital visits and more satisfied parents being able to go to work and children go to school. This year, we'll begin implementing Adolescent Immunization Improvement Initiative, which our rates are terrible in that area, and a care management initiative that we've been planning for over a year. And coincidentally, we are also applying for CMMI grant. We applied letter of intent back in December. I would like to introduce Scott Conroy. He is a director of strategic initiatives with Women's Healthcare Associates. Our organizations represent primary care pediatricians and OBGYNs in the Portland metropolitan area who serve children and pregnant mothers, which composes 70% of the OHP population. Scott, do you want to say a few words?
Before he goes on, can I ask a question?
He's just going to introduce himself.
Okay.
I'm just Scott Conroy and from Women's Healthcare Associates, a group of 70 obstetricians and other providers in the Portland market, 11 sites at all of those hospitals that were just here and working with all of those health plans that were just here. I'm available for questions, and I would for sure be willing to answer those. I, too, am privileged to be here. So
we are here to express our support for the coordinated care organization concept. We believe that private practice maternal child health providers need to be effective partners in the governance and operation of these CCOs. We endorse the integration of public and private silos of care and the support mechanisms for families. Our providers see duplicity, waste, barriers to appropriate care delivery every day within and between these silos. And we believe that a CCO should be patient family focused in the context of the medical home, which many of our practices are working on today and will in the future. Access to care as opposed to just insurance coverage should also be a high priority for CCOs. Pediatrics and maternal health have a long tradition of family-centered care with a focus on prevention and long-term outcomes. We have and we will continue to do so. We believe that transformation will only be successful through grassroots improvement within and between the silos of providers and health plans, but it must be based upon evidence and implemented in a flexible manner, knowing that each practice has unique strengths and unique populations. Utilization is best managed in the medical home, but providers need the tools, I emphasize this strongly, support an accurate patient assignment, which is not happening today, timely information, which doesn't happen today, and a payment model to enable them to manage their patient population. A consistent frustration among our providers is that they do not have these tools and support necessary to make effective change. Timely, actionable, and meaningful claims data from health plans are rarely available to providers. Practices typically do not even know when a new patient is assigned to them. Change is typically executed in a top-down fashion through regulations, policies, and rules developed without an understanding of workflows, possible unintended negative consequences, or barriers to implementing change. We strongly encourage this committee to ensure that OHA selects CCOs in every community that actively engage primary care providers. And I know that in Portland, primary care has been involved, but up until just a couple of days ago, private practice has not been. So we think this is important to enable the patient-provider relationship and continuous improvement in the medical home. A strong majority of OHP patients, I think I mentioned earlier, it's roughly 70%, utilize maternal child health providers, but health plans can fail to consider the specific needs of these populations. Health plan decisions are often made in a chronically ill adult paradigm. We would like to see more interest in partnership with CCOs on maternal child health issues, and because healthy children are the future of our state, and there's some serious issues that pediatricians are dealing with in terms of obesity and mental health issues. Our maternal child health providers have some of the strongest, longest personal bonds with their patients and families. Our providers typically have same-day access, 24-hour advice, after-hours and weekend care, and an on-call provider 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We remain a steadfast, consistent value component of the system. I want to emphasize that we have grave concerns about the possibility of CCOs being governed and operated by hospitals and or systems without the leadership of private practice, primary care, child health, and child health providers. Our providers care for a significant population of OHP patients. Often these patients have the most complex problems requiring coordinations with specialists, mental health providers, community nurses, among others. There is just vast potential for improvement, and we have much to contribute. Those are all my comments. I welcome any questions. Thank you again.
And I'm so glad that Cindy Becker and Dave Ford are here, because Doug, are you a part of that group too? Yes. Okay, Doug Riggs. Because I wanted you to hear their testimony, because these are people that have been coming to a number of us concerned about a top-down and non-inclusive group of people making decisions about their practices. So thank you very much. Okay. Yes.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to thank the Tri-County Group for bringing you into that. I think it's an advance, and look forward to that broader participation moving forward. Thanks.
Okay. And now ambulatory surgical centers.
Do I have safe?
Good afternoon, Senator Mona Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Jesse Arambidi, and I represent the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association, which represents surgery centers around the state of Oregon, and I'm also administrator of Oregon Outpatient Surgery Center in Tigard. Over the past 2 years, we've hosted a number of state legislators for tours and briefings at our ASC, our surgery center, to make the following points. ASCs can provide lower health care costs while providing high-quality care. We're known for keeping costs at a minimum through monitoring waste and redundancies. Patient safety and reduced complications also contribute to reduced medical expenses. We're committed to patient safety. Patient satisfaction is very high in our surgery centers, and patients who choose surgery centers, they do it for cost and for quality every day. We have some feedback about OHP transformation, which I would like to share briefly. Patients' choice must be assured, and systems must be inclusive. If there are limited providers and facilities in charge of all procedures, this could marginalize small providers and prevent patients from choosing surgery centers. This will drive up costs. The system must promote quality. ASCs have proven that high-quality care can be provided at significant cost savings. We want to ensure that there are high-quality-to-cost standards implemented in the CCO metrics. ASCs want to be part of the CCO building process and be allowed to deliver care in areas throughout the state. We believe that meaningful incentives, physician engagement, and market competition will ensure good outcomes and cost savings. Ambulatory surgery centers are a proven way to reduce healthcare costs through innovative money savings measures. We want a system where ASCs can contribute expertise and participate in a CCO delivery. Thank you, and I entertain any questions.
And I think it was important for you to come testify too, because there is this hospital wanting the business, the market share, and ambulatory surgical centers. And the CCOs are definitely going to be coordinating this. And not sure what the answer is, but I felt it was important for you to hear that.
We thank very you. Much want to participate. Thank you for letting me share this today.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Well, it looks like if we can, thank you very much for coming and giving your perspective. And we would like to have Dr. Goldberg come in to just answer a quick question that we forgot to ask him.
He was watching, talking with people and watching on the TV, I think.
The hallways are vacant.
Oh.
So maybe he's watching on TV and he's
okay.
Running out.
we'll just wait a couple of more minutes because we were supposed to adjourn at 3:15. Oh, there's Dr. Goldberg.
There he is. Did you run down the stairs?
He's quick.
he interrupted another meeting, probably. Senator Cruz had a specific question, and we did forget because I had the same question. Do you want to go ahead and?
Yeah, I just want to know from the perspective of CMS that giving you this money, they don't ever give anything, and they're expecting it to flow through a CCO. What is their definition? I mean, they obviously have some metrics around what needs to happen from their perspective to qualify, and that's kind of what I need to know.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Cruz, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. We have been working with CMS and showing them that as we create a better healthcare system and can save some dollars, that for every dollar we save, obviously, that's a significant amount of federal dollars. So they want to help us do this. They understand the need for some upfront investment. And what we're working with them on right now are two things. Number one, the amount of the investment that they can make, trying to quantify that. And also, they're very clear about that the dollars would need to go to healthcare transformation. A, we wouldn't get the dollars if we come through the February legislative session without moving forward on transformation. And then number two, what we're working on right now is exactly how those dollars would flow. They certainly need to go into transformation. They need to go into, we believe they're going to want them to go into CCOs. I think what we're trying to do, however, is understand that there may be some communities that need a couple of months, and can we have some bridge funding that helps get somebody July 1 through October 1 moving forward, and the dollars in that manner. So we're trying to work out those details with them.
If I could. Okay, good. Bruce, you hear lots of rumors in the building, and part of what one of the things I've been hearing is that because we build assumed savings into the budget, and that this money from CMS is going to help fill that hole, which means that it's going to care, which would mean that in some cases, or a lot of cases, it'd have to flow through the current network, wouldn't it?
Senator Cruz, let me be clear that CMS will not give us the money to fill a budget hole. We may be, I want to be sure we're not talking semantics, that, they certainly will give us, they're looking at giving us the dollars for transformation. Let me put it in a different way.
But it's still delivery of care.
Correct.
Isn't it, Bruce?
Yes. No, which is fine. And they want to see it go into transformative delivery of care, but they want to see it targeted towards CCOs for transformation and for the kinds of activities that are going to bend the cost curve for them as well as for us.
Okay, so let's assume that we have an area that, because at some point we're going to define what qualifies somebody to call themselves a CCO, and so you have a region in the state that ain't there yet, so they don't get any of this money. Is that correct? And so their people are left high and dry.
Senator Cruz, that's what we're trying to work through with CMS.
Okay.
Is exactly that. That let me put it this way. You're right. If on July 1, you have an area of the state that's not there, they would be looking at potentially some additional budget cuts in the Oregon Health Plan. What we're looking to do is distinguish between if you're not there on July 1, but you're on a good path, and you're likely to get there over the next several months, we'd like to create a process with CMS that says it, that can go into the kinds of developmental activities and the sorts of processes that will look towards an area being a CCO.
I guess, Bruce, you know, when you're here earlier, we were talking about this structure, my artistic little thing here. What I'm wondering is if that's going to be sufficient with the full knowledge that, and it may take more than months to develop risk modeling and all of the other portions, especially you get to the Tri-County area, it's going to be an in-progress thing for a considerable period of time. We know that. And even in some of the other parts of the state, they're kind of on the front end. And my fear is if we're trying to force something, we end up with something more flawed than if we were able to do the due diligence at the local level in the creation.
We're going to set forth the criteria for CCO. Or
30,000 foot.
But communities will apply. Some will hopefully apply in April and May and be up and going July 1. We hope that the federal dollars that come through will be able to go into those CCOs. There may be other communities that need a few more months to come through with an application and be certified. And I think that's some of the discussions that we're having with CMS now. What do we do in those sorts of areas where they're working through that? I think areas that aren't moving towards this won't be able to avail themselves of the federal funds.
Okay, if I could. Mm-hmm. When do you think you will have the definition of a CCO?
We Senator Cruz, we have the definition of a CCO in the proposal. And we have the definition, and we have, if you look at Appendix B, okay. D, it really sets out the criteria.
Okay.
What we'll be doing is putting that into an RFA that people will be able to respond to.
Okay. I hadn't got to the appendix yet.
But if you look at Appendix D, it goes through the criteria in quite some detail.
Okay.
Do you have the right one?
Well, it's January 10th.
I go from Appendix A to...
Keep going.
Keep going.
To Appendix C.
Keep going.
Well, wouldn't B follow C?
D, as in dog.
D.
Sorry.
It's right there. And okay. It's 11 pages.
Okay.
Okay. He's getting old. He's getting his hearing going again.
I am too.
It's my accent.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. This will be
thank
helpful.
You. Is that it?
You're welcome.
Yeah, I just okay.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you, staff, and we are now adjourned.